Hello everyone and welcome to the Smashy Business Show. Today is Tuesday, June 10th, 2025 and I'm Abdul Majid Awan.
And I'm Wadid Ahmed and we've got a packed show for you today. Firstly, we're going to be discussing how Huda Beauty has donated 1 million dirhams to the United Nations in first move as a fully independent brand. Secondly, Dubai government has appointed a new board at Majid Al Futtaim to end the billionaire heir dispute. And Emirates Airlines has partnered with the home brand Emirati home bakery. And finally, Warner Bros Discovery have split, putting OSN Plus under streaming spotlight.
The very first story of the day is very interesting because 81 million is not a small amount. So Huda Beauty has announced that a donation of 1 million dirhams will go to UNRWA, the non-profit that supports Palestinian refugees. The brand made the decision after asking its followers for suggestions on Instagram.
Now, basically, the campaign was shared across Huda Beauty, Huda Hotline, and Huda Katan's Instagram accounts, and thousands of followers responded, but it was actually UNRWA USA's comment that specifically stood out, earning them 10.5K likes, which is basically the most out of any submission on the Instagram post.
And in their comment, UNRWA USA highlighted 75 years of service to Palestinian refugees and a 30,000-strong staff presence across Gaza, the West Bank, Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan. The organization said it was best positioned to reach people in Gaza.
And Huda Katan, the Iraqi founder and co-CEO of Huda Beauty, shared the update with the caption, "This is our first act of independence. Here's to making more impactful decisions together, reflecting the brand's broader mission beyond cosmetics."
And the donation follows Huda Beauty's move to full independence after an 8-year partnership. Huda Katan bought back the minority stake previously held by TSG Consumer Partners, regaining complete control of the company she founded with her sisters.
You know, Majid, honestly, I'm not used to being proven wrong because we were discussing this yesterday and I'm like, yeah, it would be a really bad idea if she chose the UN. I just personally thought it was a really bad idea, especially with all the stories that are coming out about McNally Capital, SRS, which runs that aid foundation in Israel, which is right now under fire. I just completely thought that, you know, she would not give power to a Western-based company to actually distribute the aid. And I was proven completely wrong. And I think it's interesting. This entire story is interesting, by the way, because it tells you what people think. The fact that, you know, in that Instagram post where she's telling all of us that she's going to donate that 1 million dirhams, that $270K, that it was the UN's comment that was most liked, which basically tells you that until now, one of the most trusted organizations in the world continues to be the United Nations.
Yeah.
And people continue to trust it. But I over the years, I feel that I've developed this mistrust because I don't really see a difference in what they're actually doing.
When you look at the political side of it, it's very confusing because whenever there's in the UN Security Council, it has a very weird rule. I've had very long relationship with the United Nations. If anyone who is young knows about your Model United Nations, it's a program that was run by the UN and it's in universities. The best one happens in Harvard. So Model United Nations, the kids learn to write draft resolutions. They play as the delegates of the countries. So I've had a very closer look at how the UN actually works through resolutions and what are the discussions, moderated sessions, unmoderated sessions, caucuses. It's very complicated. But it's a way into, if you want to someday represent the UN. But what I always saw as a problem was the veto decision. And we've seen it over multiple times whenever there is a resolution in the UN Security Council to do complete stop to this genocide that's happening in Israel, the US also always comes in and vetoes it. And veto is the power that is given to 5 countries in the UN Security Council. I think it's US, Germany, Japan, France, and then one more country. China, yes. So 5 countries, they have veto power, basically. So any draft resolution that comes out after 4, 5, 10 days, 3 days, whatever days of discussions, they can just say no. That's veto power, and U.S. has been doing it. So when you look at United Nations, again, your skepticism of United Nations is very well-founded, and it's not only you. It's a lot of people who say that U.N. is a peacekeeping body which should, which was made after World War II. Before that, it was Nations League. Sorry, a history lesson, but very important to know that Nations League was made after the First World War. People wanted Nations League to just come together and solve the problems on the table, not with bombs. But it failed. Second World War happened. Second World War, UN, United Nations, as we see today, comes into place. But still, it hasn't played the role that it was supposed to play.
Yeah.
You look at the globe. You look at all the clashes happening between nations. The UN always tries to jump in. But they are, to be honest, very sadly, they're never able to stop any of those.
And this is what I mean. Like, yeah. In their comment under Huda Beauty's post, and this really stood out to me,
They
specifically said that, you know, we've been doing this for 75 years. We've been helping Palestinian refugees for 75 years.
And not only
why
Palestinian,
have they been refugees for 75 years if you've been helping? I don't think that but after seven decades, that should be the case.
When you look at it more closely, the UN has two parts. One is the decision-making part, the UN Security Council, UN DISEC, Disarmament and International Security Councils. There's UOAN, Atomic Energy Commission. There's like so many councils, so many small bodies under UN which make decisions. Like this will happen, this will not happen. Then you have the humanitarian side of UN. And that is, to be honest, a little closer to my heart. Because when you look at the humanitarian impact of those councils, UNESCO is the cultural, social cultural council. You have UN humans, WHO comes under UN. So all these things, when you look at it, the humanitarian side of UN, it's very nicely placed. They have the reach to go to like parts of the world where even the locals aren't able to help. So you look at, I have personally seen in 2008 Pakistan, we saw like devastating earthquakes. The first people on the ground were UN people. They came to help, and then all the people, all the NGOs came in, and then the local authorities with their help. So imagine local authorities know the terrain better. But even
how did that earthquake affect you, Majid? Like, did you see them firsthand on ground?
No. I live in the south of Pakistan, like extreme south in Karachi. But all my family, everyone literally lives in the north. So I belong to the northern areas, but I've lived in the south all my life. But their houses literally came down. Villages disappeared because if you've seen the mountainous terrain, it's very weird. You have a road, but then you look down and there is a village of like 40, 50 houses. Mm-hmm. And then you look up and there's houses. So it's very weird. So a lot of the earthquake literally dumped the whole area, the whole 40, 50 houses. There was nothing to be found there.
Mm.
Not even like steel and everything. It was so buried. So that way, to be honest, UN has done something. They have an impact in the world. RWA is one of the only ones which has been closer to the Palestinian cause. We talked about it yesterday. Israel banned them, literally, because they were doing good work. They were supplying aid to people who actually needed it. And Israel made a whole argument that they're helping Hamas.
Mm.
So we won't allow them.
And I remember
For that reason, I think UNRWA should get it. Because if Israel is saying that these are bad people, 100% those are good people.
Mm. To be fair, now that I think about it, I think my criticism was a bit too sharp. Because if she does not give it to the UN, I mean, who else in that comment section is she going to give it to? Like, none of us are organizations who are in charge of distributing aid.
Yeah.
So I think this is the best bet that she really has here. But,
you
know, back to just like Huda Beauty and why, you know, her reclaiming full ownership, it's so important. You know, I've actually been seeing a lot of rumors online as an avid Huda Beauty user myself. I use the powder and the lip glosses. And a lot of people, by the way, they've complained about the packaging. The packaging really does need a change. And I think that ever since Huda Beauty has stepped into the limelight again. I mean, Huda Katan has stepped into the limelight again. There was a time where she stepped back as CEO, by the way. And, you know, ever since she has been back, you have a logo rebrand. We've had so many new products, the new setting spray that's doing extremely well. So I think that her coming back, it's I think it's a priority. I think that her branding, it's definitely grown stronger. And I think with, you know, this entire charitable offer, it does definitely have kindness in it, but it's also really shaping her brand. And it's shaping it in a really important way.
I saw a video of her talking about the packaging thing that you say, and she was like, why do you care? Why do you care? Care about the product, actually the product that's inside. Don't care about the packaging.
I know what you mean, because some people complained that why did you change something?
Yeah.
But there are certain things that actually need help, like the concealer, like she needs to change the packaging, and she definitely does listen.
It help? Like if I get a biscuit in a plastic pack or a
what do you mean?
Paper-based packet.
No, Majid, it's important I'm just asking, to squeeze like, the product out.
Oh.
When you get a makeup product, imagine you're paying like 100 to 200 dirhams for something. You want to get value out of the money that you're spending. If something is not being, if you can't squeeze it out properly, do you know what I mean?
That's product. So it's a squeezable thing that comes out and it doesn't come out properly.
It needs more help there. So no, actually, packaging is important. We are going to care.
The man brain in me immediately went to the toothpaste. Like some toothpaste, it's very easy to get out the last drop.
Would you not get bothered? Would you not get bothered if you can't squeeze your toothpaste out properly?
But some of them, you can't literally, it just ends and you can't like push it out.
Yeah.
Packaging matters.
Yeah,
she's right.
And Majid Al-Futtaim, its packaging has definitely changed. So
Dubai has stepped into a resolve. Basically, the Dubai government, the ruler, and everyone has jumped in. And it's a long-running inheritance dispute at Majid Al-Futtaim Group by appointing a new board for directors, according to the Financial Times. And then everyone literally picked it up from there. The move follows years of tensions among heirs of the late billionaire founder.
Now, a special judicial committee led by DIFC Governor Issa Kazim has installed a 9-member board at Majid Al-Futtaim Capital, now the company at the top of the group structure. Now, what's so interesting is that the board now includes 5 government appointees and 4 family members only.
And Emirati businessman and financial regulator Fadil Al-Ali will chair the new board. The company has also been converted from a limited liability firm, I think LLC is the term for that we use here, to a public joint stock company, PJSC, a change that lowers board decision thresholds and is seen as a step towards a future IPO as well.
Now, the group, which owns major brands including Carrefour, Hollister, and Lego, reported more than $9 billion in revenue last year. Now, the decision to intervene reflects the scale and strategic importance of Majid Al-Futtaim's group to Dubai's economy.
And this is not Dubai's first intervention in the group's affairs. In 2022, His Highness Sheikh Mohammed appointed a judicial committee to oversee the founder's estate. And in the 1990s, while Crown Prince, he mediated a family dispute that split the business into 2 separate groups. So it's been a long-running inheritance problem. And now finally, Dubai has stepped in and they've made a board. And the board has 4 family members, 5 government-appointed members. And then there is a chair of the whole board. It shows you that Dubai is reaching maturity. To be honest, a lot of people will see it as, some guy founded and he was the great guy and now the kids are fighting over it. But to be honest, all these inheritance matters, they're not just new here in the Middle East. They're across the globe. Everyone is fighting a battle for inheritance. A lot of the billionaires were like now 70 and 80. Mm. Some of their kids don't want anything to do with it. Some of their kids want everything to do with it. But it shows you that you've reached a point of maturity where you're founding people who founded actually the main companies which you see in Dubai everywhere. Majid Al-Futtaim, you literally go anywhere and you'll find something related to
it. You know what's so interesting,
the city
Majid,
centers and MOE.
You know how you mentioned how this is not the first time that the Dubai government intervenes in their affairs, but basically in the 1990s, that affair that you specifically mentioned, that feud, by the way, was between Majid Al-Futtaim himself and his cousin, I believe Abdullah, and it was His Highness Sheikh Mohammed who stepped in and he divided the business into 2 companies.
Parts.
I don't specifically remember what they're both called, but I think it's interesting because, you know, if we've seen this, and I don't think I've seen this anywhere else. The founders here are extremely close to the royals.
Yeah.
They really are. Like, it's almost like they're close friends. And Majid al-Futaym himself, by the way, has no direct link to al-Maktoum's family.
Yeah.
They're not linked whatsoever.
I
so
think
it
it's
seems
just that,
here.
When Dubai became Dubai like 10, 15, 20 years ago, when finally they realized that they have enough potential money-wise, capital-wise, and construction-wise, that now they can start building into something incredible that we see today. All the people who had some kind of a business, they promoted them. They helped them pick it up. Khalaf al-Abtur, you shared a very nice story. They gave him the land. Hussein Sajwani got a land from the government to, do something.
And then you have Yusuf Ali.
Ali. As soon as he started the first Lulu thing, as soon as it became a hit, the Abu Dhabi government actually gave him, supported him. Even if it's not financial support, even if it's just backing, a tap on the back, like you're doing good,
$1 billion is definitely a tap on the back.
So a lot of people, I think, who were there when Abu Dhabi and Dubai were nothing and they were trying to build something here, they're very close to the royals, and those royals actually respect them a lot. Yusuf Ali, we saw on Eid, he met two Emirati like rulers, not just one, Sharjah ruler and Dubai ruler. And on the Eid before this one, the Eid al-Fitr, he met the president himself. So it's very nice to see that they keep all these people who built these big companies.
But isn't it so interesting, Majid, how they specifically chose 4 family members, but 5 government appointees?
I think they wanted to give the government an upper hand. So even if within the board, they
tried fight
to,
again.
Yeah. They should not have the upper hand. The board members should have an upper hand. Mm. Because the government members have been appointed, just been appointed. Their job is to keep them in check. So if they had a lower hand, obviously the family members would start fighting again.
We need to find out who's on that board.
We'll do. We'll definitely do.
We really do.
But yeah, talking about businesses in the Emirates. So one of the businesses we love, Worth especially loves, Home Bakery. So Emirates Airline has teamed up with Emirati dessert brand Home Bakery to offer exclusive cakes to its first class passengers throughout Eid, highlighting the carrier's continued support for homegrown businesses.
Now the collaboration features signature desserts crafted by Home Bakery. And it marks such a milestone for the local brand, which has been founded in 2011 by Emirati entrepreneur Hind Al-Mulla.
And Hind Al-Mulla started Home Bakery from her home kitchen, later expanding into a chain of 11 stores across the UAE and 1 in Saudi Arabia, with a new location set to open in Riyadh. So that makes it like 13 stores now. Her journey, shaped by resilience and self-learning, has inspired many.
Now, despite her early struggles with dyslexia that she's completely open about, I remember when I went to SEF, she was talking about it and her, you know, low academic performance. Al-Mulla has trained at the prestigious Le Cordon Bleu and built a brand now beloved by even royals, including His Highness Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al-Maktoum and His Highness Sheikh Hamdan bin Mohammed.
And known for its best-selling milk cakes and chewy melt cookies, Home Bakery's inclusion on Emirates' first-class menu reflects both brands' shared commitment to quality and celebration of local talent, elevating the in-flight experience.
No, you know what I'm actually specifically impressed by this story, Majid? It's not just my love for Home Bakery.
Yeah.
I think that a lot of people in the UAE love Home Bakery.
Yeah.
I think what stood out to me is that you have Emirates Airlines.
Yeah.
We can't even refer to it as an Emirati homegrown brand anymore, I feel.
Yeah,
this
it's
is
an
a global
brand, right?
International brand, best airline in the world. It was recently voted that, and they just recently, I believe, they achieved record profits of over $6 billion. I believe that's over 22 billion dirhams. But, you know, you have this company that's doing extremely well, and out of everyone, who do they choose to celebrate Eid with? Who do they choose to give? Which company do they choose to distribute good products to their first class, buyers? They choose Home Bakery.
It's
a sign that not only is the bakery performing extremely well, it's seen as first class. And it is. It is best. First class. It's not cheap. Home bakery is not cheap. I would not say that it is. But, you know, it's seen as first class. It's seen as luxurious. And I think that's completely incredible. And by the way, with home bakery, its story is so interesting. It's because cafe culture was not always big here, Majid.
Yeah.
You know, I've lived in the UAE my entire life. One of the first cafes to actually go big and make it was home bakery. So I think that's, you know, here, like, credit is definitely due.
Yeah, and Hindal Mulla's story is inspiring, to be honest. She is one of the people I love out of all the stories that we do about founders, because fighting dyslexia and then, because of that, having low academic performance, a lot of people count you out. Even if you have like a small problem with mathematics or anything, people start counting you out in early age, like, oh, this kid doesn't know this. This is basic. This is that. So it's very nice to know that someone who had this problem, like, conquered it literally and then came out and made a brand, and it's so famous now.
And especially when you're a woman, you are counted out.
Another hurdle, right?
She said it herself that at some point when she was actually, because she started it from her home, when she was actually trying to open the store itself, they wanted her to be in the food court. I mean, are you kidding me? And for me, by the way, I was extremely surprised to hear this, because I'd assume that if you're Emirati in this country, you'd be given first priority. But no, because she was a woman, she was offered the food court, and she completely did not stand for it. Exactly. Yeah. She did not stand for it. And then, you know, she opened her first shop and she's here today. But by the way, it's not just Hindal Mulla, Majid.
Yeah, a lot of the women
coffee,
face this.
No, not even women. The coffee and the cake croissant culture in the Gulf is absolutely insane. I mean, the quality, just like recently we reported how there's this bakery, Libre Bakery. It's the first Bahraini bakery to open in New York. Yeah. So it's you know, when you see the coffee culture here and how beautiful it is, it's nice to finally see people begin appreciating it, because I don't think anyone does it like the Arabs. I really do.
To be honest,
nobody does it like the Arabs in the food industry.
And there's one story which has international like relevance, but somehow we have found a local angle, and it is a local angle. So the story is Warner Brothers Discovery. They are a big giant, everyone knows them, has announced a major corporate split, dividing the media giant into two publicly traded companies by mid-2026, so next year. The move reshapes the company's global strategy, especially in streaming.
Now, the two new entities are actually going to be streaming and studios, which includes HBO Max, Warner Bros. Film and TV studios, DC studios and content libraries, and the second part is going to be global networks encompassing CNN, Discovery Plus, and linear and sports cable channels.
And importantly for the Middle East and North Africa region, WBAD's 30% stake in OSN, which is nearly $55 million, it just happened. There was a big giant event in Atlantis, and everyone was there. It was such a well-organized and very posh event. Will now fall under the streaming and studio division, most probably, rather than the global networks, reflecting OSN Plus digital-first nature.
And that means OSN Plus will be overseen by the same leadership team driving Warner Bros. Discovery's global streaming ambitions, including CEO David Zaslav, and this could signal closer ties and greater content collaboration in the future.
And as the regional streaming race intensifies, OSN Plus, already known for exclusive HBO and Warner Brothers titles in MENA, may emerge as a key growth asset for the new streaming-focused division for Warner Brothers in the post-split landscape. The funny thing about this is that OSN Plus is the streaming part of OSN itself. And Warner Brothers wants to split it into two companies where streaming and studios go on one side, and the legacy media and the broadcasting and the channels, which are now, to be honest, when was the last time you watched TV?
Oh my God,
right?
Honestly, the only person I see watching TV is my dad, and he's on BN watching
so
football.
It's a generation which has, like, after even after my father, my generation, we don't watch TV. We saw it for like the first 15, 16 years of our life, and there was no phones and no computers. And I remember I bought my first computer at 10 or 11 years of age. Now a kid is born with a phone in hand, or at least an iPad, right? So they have something. But my generation even has stopped. We grew up with TV, and even we have stopped watching it. So obviously cable TV is a dying business, or at least it has like a very short shelf life now. So streaming is the big thing. I think that is why Warner Brothers, such a big giant in the world, is trying to split both of them to see which one is doing better. And I think it's kind of like the idea is that whatever they earn from here, from the streaming and studios thing, they will try to cover the losses for the cable TV division.
I don't even think that it's actually the TV channels. Yeah. I think it's the TV channels themselves that are dying. Yeah. Because, you know, and even I do this in our household. We have a TV, right?
Yeah.
I sign on to Netflix. I make sure I'm signed into OSN Plus.
Yeah.
I make sure I'm signed on to Apple TV.
Yes.
So I use quite literally every single streaming service. So I think that this is an extremely strategic move from their side.
I think with TV, cable TV, the problem still is the choice, because now you have so much choice. You can have literal four movies on continue watching list, and whenever you feel like, you can pick one movie and watch it. With TV, you still have to watch what they're offering you.
Oh, imagine.
So when you don't have a choice, I think the person will run away, be like, don't want it.
And Magic, you know why this move, it's also so smart? It's because of the fact that, okay, now they've split Warner Bros, right? You got the streaming, and then you got the cable TV. What's actually going to happen? Because the cable TV, it's according to their press release, it's been reducing their profits. It's not been making
good
money. Yeah. And what does this do? When they actually come and they publish their balance sheets and people see those documents, what's going to happen is that the company as a whole, it's losing profit.
Yeah.
And that's going to look really bad to who? Investors.
Yeah.
They're not going to invest in Warner Bros. Yeah. So the reason why I believe they split the business is because now each one of them, they're going to get their own balance sheet.
Yeah.
And if you have Warner Bros. Discovery streaming doing extremely well, making really good profits, it's actually going to stand out in the balance sheet. And it's not going to be overshadowed by cable TV, because that's a separate company now. And then they're going to have more investors that are going to be stepping in, that are going to be going to want to put money in Warner Bros. Discovery, and that means they're going to want to put money in OSN Plus streaming too. So that's why this move, this split, it's so important, because they need to attract more investors. And if they're
and
with investors are the kind of people that you can't just give them logic. You need to give them numbers. You need to give them a balance sheet. Yeah. And if it's negative, I mean, you know, I'm stepping out. If I'm an investor, I'm stepping out. So I think this is a extremely good look for them.
Yeah.
And thank you so much for watching, everyone. That's a wrap for today. Make sure
to
follow us.
You have an interview, I have the closing in the interview.
I am so sorry.
It's fine.
I am so sorry.
I did the interview. It was with Kudra App creative director Jasim Al Nashmi. He's a great guy. Wait for the interview. He's one of the very rare Kuwaiti businessmen that I have met. And he's very young. He's 32. And the funny thing was, usually whenever we host someone, it's someone from Dubai, Abu Dhabi, or Saudi Arabia, or someone well-known from the industry. But this time, we found a literal startup owner. He's the creative director and partner at Kudra Global, which is a global holding company in Kuwait. Kuwait being the operative word. A person from Kuwait coming for a Smashy Business interview. Keep watching. Jasim Al Nashmi next here, right here, right now. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Smashy Business Show. We have a very special guest with us today, and the product that they're offering is exceptional. When I read about it, I was like, oh, this is something new. We have Jasim Al Nashmi with us, the creative director and partner at Kudra. Welcome to the show, Jasim.
Thank you so much. Very good. Thank you.
How's the weather treating you? Let's start off with
it's tonight. Humid, but it's fine. I came from a hotter climate.
Oh, where were you?
Kuwait.
Oh, nice. Yeah. So, doing something there, we'll come back to that. But Jasim, first question, anyone who's watching, who wants to understand what you guys are doing, let's start from the very beginning. What is the Kudra app, and what problem is it solving, and how did you find that problem?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Kudra is a freelance marketplace or freelance platform. It's a digital space where people can find freelancers to do many different services. and a place where freelancers who have these talents and want to offer them as a form of second income for them, they can offer them on the app, they can be exposed, they can find clients and get hired for jobs. So this is kind of the opportunity that we saw in the region, is that there isn't something that's locally focused on this kind of talent that we have. So that's why the app is here, and that's what it's doing. It's creating this, you know, cross-cultural environment.
You said culture, and that's a very important word because apps can change culture. We've seen mm-hmm. that with Facebook, all the big ones that we have right now. My best question that I have right now, do you have an origin story? Did you come up with this idea during a friend's talk, or was it a board meeting? What's the origin story of the Qudra app? How did you like come up with the idea?
Yeah, I mean, it started kind of, you know, during COVID, a little bit after, where, you know, remote working became more and more popular. Yeah. First, it was for people working in corporate jobs that are working from home. And then there was this big growth. I mean, there was already freelancers doing jobs from before. But this increase in the market, especially in the MENA region, it became normalized. It became very normal for big companies to be working with individual freelancers to get these jobs done, whether it's graphic design, translation, web design, UI, UX, you name it. So this became very popular. It became normalized. And that's where we saw this opportunity for an app that is both Arabic and English that can be used in our region very easily from clients to freelancers.
The point about Arabic, a lot of freelancing apps like the big ones across the globe, they're only focused on English.
Yes.
So apart from Arabic, what is your USP with Qudra app? What does it help for the Arabic people and otherwise as well? What's your best USP?
I mean, the value of the app, you know, when we're looking at what other apps are, you know, what they have available, the value is, you know, there's a lot of Arabic speaking clients that are, or let's say startups, agencies that are looking for work, or they're looking to hire someone to do a job. And then the same with the freelancers, a lot of experienced people. And they prefer Arabic, of course. So this is giving that opportunity, and it's making both sides more comfortable in the working environment. You know, they're not forced to use English if they don't want to.
So it's an Arabic first platform.
Yes.
Okay. Perfect. Let's talk about the freelancers and the both. Let's talk about the mm-hmm. people who are on the both sides of the table.
Yeah.
The freelancers and the people who want mm-hmm. to hire them. Do you have any specific numbers that you can share, like which you can publicly share, or the clients that are mostly there on your platform, or the mm-hmm. freelancers that you see, like, okay, graphic designing is our biggest thing. Any updates, any insights on that?
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you for sure, like, graphic design is number one. There's a lot of startups that need a graphic designer really quickly. You know, the first thing you do when you have a startup is, oh, I need a branding. So that is the most common, I would say. But then there's all of these other services. There's legal, there's translation, copywriting, photography, videography. So there's a lot of these other professions. But graphic design is very popular. In terms of numbers, I could say there's 3,000 freelancers on the app registered at the moment. And there's around 1,000 to 1,500 clients, you know, on the customer side who are looking to hire people. And this is for the people that have registered, you know, besides people that come in and out for quick jobs.
Nice. And I read that you've officially launched in Dubai via N5. That's a major milestone. First of all, congratulations for that.
Thank you.
Why did you choose Dubai? I know it's become kind of a cliche question. A lot of people are like, oh, you know why Dubai. Mm-hmm. But your reason, why would you choose Dubai as the next step for Qudra?
Right, yeah. I mean, we started in Kuwait.
Yeah.
It was going really well. It still is. And so that's when we decided we need to expand. Now, what's the next city to go to? You know, we don't see it as as a milestone that we're in Dubai, but rather a strategic move.
Yeah.
So it was very important for us to make this move, be in Dubai, because of the amazing pool of talent that is in Dubai. Freelancers from every single profession, and that are very skilled, very, very adept at what they're doing. So that's from the freelancer side, but also from the businesses side. I mean, business is booming in Dubai always. So again, businesses in Dubai are sometimes looking to work with, you know, big companies, and others that are looking to work with individuals or small agencies, which you can find also on Qudra. So from both sides, it's provided that advantage because of the big kind of business in Dubai,
yeah,
and the big pool of talent.
Yeah. One of the things that whenever there's a fintech platform or there's a tech platform which is digitalized, when you use the word digital, the biggest question for anyone, client, any person who is on the table, who is a stakeholder, trust. Trust is one of the biggest questions.
Yes.
So how do you establish that? Do you have a process where you check the freelancers? How do they apply? How do they become registered? And then the clients also, because a lot of freelancers I have known over the last few years, they have complaints about clients, late payments. How do you ensure
exactly
that all of that through Qudra?
Yeah. I mean, of course, you know, when we started, we did our research. We looked into other platforms that are providing similar services. And this has been an ongoing issue with all of these platforms, because at the end of the day, it's an anonymous figure that you're working with. They're on your screen. That's all you know about them. So first of all, we vet our freelancers. We make sure that anyone that is on the app has been vetted, is providing a good portfolio, and we can see that they have the ambition and dedication to complete their projects. So that's the first step, which is the vetting. Secondly, when it comes to payments, what happens is the client pays Qudra.
Oh.
And the money is in escrow.
Nice.
And hasn't been received. The what the freelancer knows is that their payment is with us.
Nice.
And it will be released once they complete the project. And of course, this differs from freelancers to freelancer. There's milestones, there's, you know, 50%, 50%. But the important thing is the client knows that their money is safe with us and hasn't been released to the freelancer until they complete the project. So that way it creates a very secure payment. And also from the freelancer side, they know that the money isn't with the client and they might, you know, change their mind. It's actually with us. If they complete the project, they're going to be receiving the full amount.
That's one of the best things I've
mm-hmm.
heard. With trust, next question, follow-up is on community. So once you trust someone, you build a community. How strong is your community, and how do you like keep them engaged? For example, if a freelancer is registered, hasn't gotten any gigs in the 2 months, how do you keep them engaged? What's the process?
Mm-hmm. This is one of the reasons we're in Dubai. We started in Kuwait. We started to kind of organize these events for these
nice.
these creative individuals. And not only build a digital community, but also a physical one. We're there with them. We're meeting them face to face. So this has been an important part in Kuwait, and that's a big part of why we're in Dubai. We really want to grow this creative community, have these events, meet them face to face, have educational events. So they also get to know one another. You know, all
yeah.
of these creatives create their own, you know, micro communities,
yeah.
And also it's a big advantage for us and them to be in Dubai together and be creating this kind of
yeah.
cross pollination.
That's a nice word, cross-pollination. I'll use that somewhere someday. But yeah, any success stories that you've heard which happened through Qudra app, any real-life stories which you can share?
Yeah, there's two stories. One of them is a motion designer in Kuwait.
Nice.
The funny thing about this person is they're very, very talented. They do beautiful work. For the past few years, they've just been, you know, since graduating, they've just been working with family and friends who know them and know they're good, and they're like, oh, can you do this job? But they can do much more. And we were aware of that, so we recognized the talent. Because of our relationships, because we are already creating these relationships with companies in Kuwait, big corporations, we were able to kind of connect these two and sign a deal between the motion designer and this big corporation. Now they don't need their 9-to-5 job because, you know, they're dedicated to working with this client. That's one of them. The other one is a graphic designer who was, again, not very well known. But on our app, because she was building a very good rating, she was always at the top.
Nice.
Of the search, and so she got many projects. Besides all of the projects that she gets from many different clients in Qudra, there is one client that was working with them every single month on a new project, always, because that person maybe has more than one company, and so it was an ongoing relationship because you had a satisfied customer.
Yes.
And you had a freelancer that's doing an excellent job every time.
And at the end of the day, you were very happy because it's you that is facilitating the whole process.
Yes,
and
exactly.
It's a nice feeling, I think.
Absolutely.
It's a great
Absolutely.
Feeling.
Yeah.
Next question would be about future. Very simple question. You're launching, you've launched in Dubai. What do you see? Where do you see yourself? Or have you set KPIs, goals, anything for the next 2-3 years, next 5, maybe 10 years? Dubai is not going anywhere for the next decade at least.
Yeah, I mean, Dubai alone is going to be a great city to be involved with. The idea for Qudra has always been a MENA region platform.
Nice.
So starting in Kuwait and now going to Dubai, eventually, 1 to 2 years, the growth would be to the rest of the MENA region,
yeah.
Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Oman, Egypt. That is always the idea, is to expand, but not, you know, the important thing is to expand in the MENA region. I mean, there's freelancers already from Brazil.
Nice.
That are on the app. You know, the idea is that the customer base, the clients that are looking for services are in the region. But freelancers can be from anywhere.
Nice.
You know, they can join. The growth is always to be in the MENA region, to be providing this Arabic and English, you know, bilingual platform.
Nice. I have 2-3 questions. What does Qudra mean? I'm not an Arabic speaker. Very important question.
Yeah.
What does Qudra mean?
Yeah, yes.
Because if I, just let me guess, because it's interesting to
okay.
guess. I think Qudrat is a word in Urdu, which means nature.
Okay.
But
I
don't know if it's near to
Qudrat. Qudrat, huh?
Yeah, so okay. It has a third then.
Okay.
What does Qudra mean?
Yeah, Qudrat is like the plural of Qudra in Arabic.
Oh.
But Qudra means ability,
nice.
Skill, talent, like that kind of thing, ambition, dedication. So everything kind of, yeah, I mean, the meaning of it is related to your ability to work and your interest to work, your
yeah.
passion to work. So that's the meaning, you know, simply put. And it's a nice word.
Yeah, it's a very nice word. Whereas the names sometimes stick, like Apple sticks. We went to Qatar for Qatar Web Summit. We met Snoonu. It's a very nice Qatar-based brand, but they had a very interesting story. So names have
right.
very nice
yeah.
resonance.
Yeah.
Right? Snoonu is a bird, I think. It's a very famous bird in Qatar.
Okay.
So, but all these
yeah.
names, they make yeah. up something. They mean something.
Yeah.
And that, I think, brings resonance to your brand eventually.
Exactly.
Someday people are like,
yeah.
oh, I remember Qudra Correct. Because it means this and has this platform.
Yeah,
Any advice for any budding entrepreneurs? You're the creative director. You're a partner. You've been through the ranks. Any 3 top-of-the-head advices for any guy, any person, any new one, any old one maybe,
mm-hmm.
a 50-year-old trying to start a startup,
mm-hmm,
anything.
Mm-hmm.
3 top advices.
Okay. I just wanted to add one thing about
Qudra. Yeah.
The logo, the Q of Qudra
yeah.
Is coming from the magnifying glass. The shape
nice.
Of it is coming from the magnifying glass, which is about the search. And we all know, you know, from when Google started, how important
yeah.
search is.
Yeah.
So that's where it all starts, is we have this huge pool of talent, and you just enter Qudra and search, and you'll find someone that's right for you. So in terms of advice, seriously, like, I'm a creative myself.
Yeah.
I have my own business. I've been through the struggles, right? So I know what it's. I know how hard it is, and I can tell you very clearly the hardest part of my business is finding clients. getting them to stick with you to the end of the project. I mean, payment is the second problem, but the first one is always having clients coming in to continue work with you. So this is for anyone starting a business or, you know, working on a business. And the advice is to, you know, always like kind of push on and trust yourself, which is something that I didn't have in the beginning. I didn't, you know, trust myself. And there was, you know, this very slow, you know, step-by-step process of like putting myself out there. Yeah. And to be on Qudra, and this is, you know, it's very easy in this day and age because it's digital. Yeah. You know, you're just putting, you know, you don't even have to put your picture, but, you know, you put your profile pic, you put some a bio about yourself, and then you just leave it there, right? So it's not a big ask from the freelancer to do this. It's quite easy. It's low maintenance, you know, not something you have to worry about. But when you do it, then you've put yourself out there. That's the first step. And then you get hired for projects, you know. The second advice is always to work hard and make sure you're the best. but really, really, it's, I mean, I noticed, you know, from businesses, the second most important thing is how good you are. But the first is to always make sure you're putting yourself out there and you're getting your clients. And so that's what Qudra is there for. And what we do for the freelancers that we're vetting and we want people to see is we're putting them at the top of the list. And so that's something very valuable for any freelancer that works with us. We are giving them the exposure they need.
The thing that you said that you didn't believe in yourself, but I think you would then have gone to your support structure, like you go to family, your friends.
Right, yeah.
Likewise, the platform that you've built is kind of like a support structure.
Absolutely.
So it's a very nice journey. Founder journeys are the best stories, to be honest. Thank you so much, Jasim, for coming.
Appreciate it.
Anything you want to say to the freelancers before we go, or the clients who are looking for anyone, any graphic designer, any legal guy?
Anything you want to say? Yeah, of course. I mean, first of all, the freelancers, I mean, we're now here in Dubai. You know, we're licensed in Dubai. And we are going to start to be doing these events here in Dubai. There's also new features that we're adding to the app that's going to help the whole community. But we really want to say to the freelancers to make sure that they just make a profile on the app and put themselves out there, you know, put their work in the portfolio. People don't, this is the important thing, people don't know how talented you are. You are talented. You need to show this to the world. That's the important thing for the freelancers. And so that's what Qudra is here for, is to make you shine and to make you have a second income, or in some cases, a first income. And so for the clients, I'm talking to businesses, to agencies, to startups, and to individuals who are like thinking about, you know, opening a coffee shop or a, you know, a, some sort of shop, and are still thinking about it. Qudra is a great opportunity where you don't have to go to a big company to do your branding or something like that. You can work with an individual one-on-one and get your job done quickly, efficiently, and as comfortably as possible between you and the freelancer that you find. And, you know, you can message them and talk to them and be like, oh, I'm comfortable with this person. So then you start to work with them. So we're talking from big companies who want to work with individuals and don't want to hire and fire all the time. It's a very easy process where you work with them on a project basis. And this is very important for let's say, agencies, mostly marketing agencies.
Events companies, I think, also.
Events companies,
because
absolutely.
They have a season in Dubai where every event is happening.
Yeah, so these kind of seasonal
companies. Next 4 or 5 months are like clean slate. So you literally pay them 4 or 5 months for nothing.
Exactly.
But yeah, it's a nice idea to have freelancers available.
Yes.
Qudra is your best bet
now. Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely.
So thank you so much, Jasim, for joining us on the Smashy Business Show. Thank you so much, everyone, for listening today. And if you still haven't registered as a freelancer, whatever you're doing, just go to the Qudra app and register. And if you're a client, perfect pitch by Jasim that this is the best platform to find all the talent that is there, not only from the Middle East, he said Brazil, everywhere in the world, people are registered there. You can find the best talent you want. Thank you so much for watching the Smashy Business Show. It is a Smashy Business Show, the Smashy part of the Augustus Media Podcast Network. Have a great day. See you tomorrow.